Hello and welcome to Two Nerds Sitting on a Couch, in which two nerds sit on a couch and discuss science fiction and fantasy.
Why did I watch this movie without you?
I have no idea.
I must have been, I don't know, maybe I was trapped here and you were visiting somebody somewhere.
You watch a lot of shit without me, though.
Yeah. Well, I try to watch stuff that I don't think you're going to be interested in, and this one... Like, turns out I wasn't interested in.
And I was. So that was kind of messed up.
Well, okay. So this is Upstream Color. It came up when we were talking about trippy movies, like 2001, which is...
a little backstory. 2013, Upstream Color, written, produced, directed, scored, and... Acted by Shane Carruth.
Shane Carruth.
He burst onto the scene with Primer. In 2000, I don't remember.
I don't think that I knew that the first time I saw this, but as soon as you said it, I was like, oh, yeah, you can tell. Well, he also did the camera work in a lot of these shots. And it's like, and the soundtrack.
And
you can totally see how, like, these movies are, like, you can see what he does, like, his style really easily, just with these two samples. I'm sure if he came out with another movie and I saw it, I would be like, oh, my God, this is that dude.
Yeah, and I don't think
it's really
he's,
distinctive once you see two data points.
He's come out and said that he doesn't want to make any more movies. So
I wouldn't either if I were him.
This could be it. Jesus.
I don't want him to make any more
anyway,
movies. I really liked Primer. I really thought that was a fantastic movie. It was really well, like, encapsulated. It had a brilliant premise. You know, I mean, like, the elevator pitch of that is just awesome. Like, if you have an awesome elevator pitch... I mean, you could have a crappy execution, I guess, but I mean, it was super low budget and it was really well done. And it was like mind bending to the point where you get to the end of it and you're like, oh my God, I need to watch this maybe a dozen more times.
Yeah.
Just to figure, and then go to Wikipedia to figure out what the hell happened.
Right. Well, and I mean, I was just about winding up to say this before you really quick turn on the podcast.
Cause you were about to say something and not record it.
No.
If it's not recorded and sampled.
Oh, dude. Anyway, yeah. I was just going to say that I felt like Upstream Color, like, I thought one of the strengths of Primer was how unbelievably, unrelentingly naturalistic it was.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, that totally fucking worked for me, you know? I mean, I think that's what absolutely sold its premise.
Yes, but unlike this movie, it had a narrator.
It had a narrator and...
Which helped.
Well, and it had a, like, understandable dialogue and the rest of it. Like, I don't... These people talk to each other in ways that I don't... You know, whatever.
Yeah.
So, just quick plot synopsis and then we can kind of go off about it. But, so it opens with a, you know, there's a pair of kids who, you know, they're, like, digging in the dirt. They get these grubs out of the dirt. There's, like, blue stuff on the plants.
Mm-hmm.
Take the grubs, they, like, make tea out of the grubs, and then they start, like, acting in concert with, you know, like, they close their eyes, and then they're moving in sync, and doing things in sync, and at one point they, like, they're doing sort of like a, like, fight choreography, but it's, like, perfectly, you know.
Even though their eyes are closed. Yeah, I mean, I guess I was calling it telempathy. Because it's like, you know, they're not, like, necessarily... Well, I guess in some ways we find out later that they are sharing thoughts or at least memories.
Right.
Because there's a whole scene where whatever. Anyway, so this guy gets this idea to use this stuff and create an extreme hypnotic suggestion with it to get people to... He's a con man. He gets them to give them all his money basically by making them think the floor is lava. And then they write all their checks to him.
And the way the woman, I can't remember her name, Chris, the way Chris is, you know, ends up having to, like, it feels like a date rape.
Yeah, very
she
much
so.
She is
roofied in a bar.
Yep.
And goes home and has this horrific violation of her everything, of her life occur. And then, you know, and so, yeah, so he makes her do all this weird shit while she, you know, is under this extreme suggestibility.
Yeah. And she has to, like, copy out all of the words of Walden and then make little ring chains out of the pages as one of her tasks. that she does overnight, and like it's like this guy is just basically setting up all the things to get all of her money, and then he's like, okay, you know, you want to eat again, and then he leaves, but then she has these bugs under her skin, and you know, you don't necessarily know if it's real or withdrawal or whatever, but then for some reason, like, there's this guy who has these speakers that he puts in the ground that make these noises that are, that make the worms rise up to the surface, and she shows up.
Like, which draws her to him as well.
Yeah. Like, and so she's just like, I've got this, I can't get them out, right? And so he, like, does some sort of surgery on her and transfers them into a pig.
Right.
Who then he, like, lets loose into this whole thing of pigs.
Right. And you see like a piece of paper, and he writes down her name, and then he writes down the tag number on the ear. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole list of names and tag numbers. So presumably all of these pigs correlate to somebody's like psychic worms. You know, I mean, it's
right.
I mean,
well, and you get the sense that this guy is like he's attracting these people, but he doesn't really like what how did the first one happen, and how did he know what to do? And then how did whatever. It doesn't matter. He's not the guy who did this to her in the first place. He's just some other guy who raises pigs and also is some sort of audio engineer and puts out these bizarre, like, Amon Tobin-like
right.
soundscapes, you know, or like, I guess a Shane Carruth-like soundscape of, you know, whatever random noises. He's fascinated by these noises, and it's questionable whether or not, like, he was maybe one of the first to be roofied by the con
maybe,
man.
Maybe.
You know, and then he like fixed it himself with the pig and realized that he could fix other people or something. But there's a lot to do with sound in this, mm-hmm. where like she keeps hearing noises, or you know, you watch this guy, the audio engineer, just sit there making various noises and playing with them and whatever, and it's just sort of like
Then she, you know, she comes home and like she goes to call the police, but then what's she gonna tell them? She doesn't remember anything.
Well, because she kind of wakes up in her car in a median,
right?
Well, after like presumably... the guy just dumped her there, you know.
Yep. So she loses her job.
What he's doing is shady too.
Right. I mean, he clearly. Like he may not be involved in the thief's activities, but he's certainly not making the situation better for anybody.
Right. Although we don't necessarily know what his angle is, because he's already got the pigs. He doesn't need to put parasites in the pigs. They don't do anything for him. And when the pigs give birth to other pigs, he just chucks them in a stream. So,
right?
Like, is he doing if he's not connected to
them? Well,
that
because
guy?
He and then there's a scene where like a guy's like, "I would totally take piglets from you because I got a petting zoo," and he's like, "No."
Oh yeah.
So like clearly the pigs are only there for people's like psychic worm parasites.
It's been a long time since I read the Wikipedia explaining all of this, but what if this is the life cycle of a parasite where it has to be gestated in a person, transferred to a pig, and then the pigs have to give birth, and then you have to throw the fetuses into the thing, and the cycle stops when at the end she finally breaks the cycle.
I mean, I think you could suggest that. Anyway, so she gets involved with Shane Carruth, who also has had this like pig parasite situation happen to him.
Yeah,
like,
and they both had their lives implode in similar ways.
Yeah, he's like, I embezzled from my company and I lost my broker license.
Which you realize he didn't. He was hypnotically suggested to do that.
Right, exactly. And so they end up, you know, so they end up in a relationship with one another, and like, you know, like their pigs get together and have babies, but then the guy takes and puts them in a sack and throws them in the river, which completely freaks the both of them out. Like, he attacks one of his coworkers.
Well, she thinks she's pregnant at one point.
Well, she's testing pregnant at one point.
Yeah, and the doctor's like, no, you're not pregnant.
Right.
So, I mean, like, she's connected to her pregnant pig. And then freaks out, like, I can't find them. And he kind of freaks out with her a little bit.
No, he does freak out. It's just in a different way. Like, he attacks his coworker because it's like, that the, you know, daddy pig is like, I need to attack you.
Right.
Anyway, I don't know that necessarily pigs work that way, but it doesn't matter.
I think they even made a comment that pigs don't work that way normally.
But... Right. But humans work that way. Possibly.
Right. Well, and there's this like, weird psychic connection between them and their pig.
So then, you know, so then they... You know, she eventually kind of figures out what's going on in terms of like the whole psychic.
Yeah, fuckery. She sort of like uses the force to find the pig farm
Right. And she, well, and like the, like you know, I mean, this is very much an experimental film. So like the first time she and Shane Carruth get together, like they wake up in the morning and there's a scene of them like in bed, lying in the middle of the pig field, you know,
Right.
what there's scenes of the sound engineer like walking around watching other people's lives, you know,
Yeah,
like
by
there's a
like
sense
touching each one of the pigs, then he
he
can
can,
see
yeah,
them.
he can enter their lives. And like, you know, so there's a scene where he comes in and he's like walking around Shane Carruth and she comes into the room and sits down and then like flicks her eyes up and looks at him.
Which is the
Like she's
experimental
like,
movie way of saying that she went and found him in person, IRL. But yeah, and I think that like that his character like is that like he's like, you know, sampling all of this audio of the world around him, and this is just another way for him to sample the world around him. He's sampling other people's lives, you know, whatever.
So then, so two things, well, multiple, there are multiple takes I think you can do on this,
Yeah, I mean, the
right?
movie is slippery enough that you can make it be whatever you want, really. I
Right.
mean, within the range of like addiction or mental illness or like take it factually for what happened.
Right. But yeah, but I think both addiction and mental illness are really easy glosses.
Yeah.
You know, like there were points when it felt like bliss a little bit.
Right, which I think was one of the contexts that we brought this movie up in, where I was like, oh
Yes.
my God, I've seen this movie, we should watch it.
Right.
Which I guess I don't regret saying it. I just don't like this movie.
Yeah,
It's
you
like
know
not my
what?
bag, that's
You
all.
don't have to like it. I just think that I don't know. I mean, in the category of trippy fucking movies that you're gonna have really polarized responses to, this is totally in that. You know what I
Yeah,
mean? The
I mean
Fountain,
it's a
this,
filmmaker's movie.
Bliss,
And
yeah.
actually, I mean, The Fountain was way more intelligible, I think, because like 2/3 of it was actual movie, like scripted movie, and the last third of it was, or you know, they're all interspersed, but the part with like the tree and the bubble was definitely like more on the experimental side, whereas
I
the
guess. I
other
think
two were
that.
actual straightforward movies.
I think. I don't know how straightforward any of that was, though. I mean, that was pretty bonkers.
Yeah, well, the Aztec part maybe not as straightforward, but the part where it's like modern day with Hugh Jackman trying to find the cure, like that was super intelligible. I mean, I feel like The Fountain was there to show these three disparate ways of making movies in the first place,
Right.
and then tell the same story three different, really different ways, and then, you know, have them like interwoven with like similar metaphors and structures, where it's like, you know, they kind of talk about this myth of the fountain of youth, and and like later it's like, well, the fountain of youth is actually, you know, associated with this star or supernova or whatever, and then like he actually goes there literally at the end, or
Right.
metaphorically, maybe it's just a metaphor. Maybe the whole
Right.
thing is a metaphor, you know, who knows? And that's kind of how this movie works, the same way, where it's like, is it a metaphor? I don't know, you tell me. And I kind of get this sort of like James Franco, like, I might be gay, but I might have just played a gay character. I don't know, you tell me.
No, oh my
I'm
God.
just that good of an actor. And I'm just sort of like, oh my
I think that
God,
is a
really?
deeply unfair read because I think that James Franco is the most insufferable person on the planet, and I think that this is just regular insufferable.
Yeah, no, you're right. I'm using hyperbole
Okay,
to make a
that's fine.
point that it is unfair to this movie, which like to be fair, like I was willing to watch this movie again. I mean, it was just the movie the first time through by myself without having read anything about it or under like I didn't know anything other than the little blurb, which let's just say whatever blurb anybody writes for this movie is going to be woefully inadequate
No,
because it
it
can't
won't
really
work.
capture what I mean, I feel like we told the story and yet
It's and
I
it's
feel
pretty
like we're not
simple.
really getting across what happened
No, because
because it's
it is
weird.
very, I mean, well, okay,
It's like
so
an
go,
emotional movie.
so
You like,
right.
you know, you understand it on an emotional landscape. And this is my problem with it, really. It's not that I didn't like the movie, it's that I have a hard time relating to movies that are told emotionally like this.
See, and I guess I thought, I mean, especially if you're doing the mental illness or addiction read, which are both, you know, I mean, they're both kind of mental illnesses when you get right down to it, right?
Yeah.
That you know, the sense of dislocation, the sense of like it is a linear film on many, but it does like skip around, it does like back up, and you know, there is a like a where are we in time little bit. And I think that that sort of it induces that feeling in you. You know what I mean? Like, that's the intention is to sort of, you know, give you the impression of how this feels on the inside.
Yeah. And that's exactly, I think, why this movie is in the same category as mm-hmm. The Fountain, as Bliss,
yep.
as 2001. Because all of those movies, I feel like, at least at the very end of 2001, it gets real impressionistic. It gets emotional. Yeah. You understand it on an emotional level because the filmmaking itself doesn't make any sense. Like, you know, Dave Bowman wanders around. I mean, so like the story of 2001 is just, you know, that they find this monolith. Actually, the monkeys find it way back when they were Neanderthals or pre-Neanderthals, back when we were apes. They find it and it sort of...
Australopithecines.
It pushes us into... it pushes us along the road of evolving intelligence.
Right.
Like in the book, it has them tying a knot. So it like teaches them to use their intelligence on the world around them.
Tool use, basically.
Yeah. Or like, I mean, also in the book was, you know, hitting them, the right. other bad tribes with a rock or
because every tool is a weapon if you hold it right.
Yeah. And so like that, it kind of gives them this sort of evolutionary leap forward, and then like much, much later, we find one of these monoliths on the dark side of the moon in a crater below the surface, just randomly, whatever, but it's like placed there as if to say, when you guys finally do make it up to the moon, mm-hmm. You know, let us know. And then so it shoots this thing up to Jupiter, and it's like, so then the next part of it is like, when you guys make it to Jupiter, let us know. So there's a monolith orbiting Jupiter. That's 2 kilometers wide, and so they send a mission out to it, which then the AI decides to go crazy and kill everybody, and Dave Bowman escapes in a pod into the monolith and has this really trippy last part of the movie, which is all emotional, where he sort of sees himself in a hotel room, like his pod is in the hotel room, he gets out in a spacesuit and sees mm-hmm. himself like having dinner as like kind of older version right. of himself, and then like the spacesuited part and the pod disappear. It's just him having dinner as an older version of himself. And then he hears something in the other room. So he goes in there and looks. And then he sees like an old version of himself.
Right.
And then, you know, and they sort of interact, but like, not really. I mean, you're getting the sense that like his whole, like if you were to you know, mess with time or see time as a gestalt rather than experience it linearly. I think that's kind of what it was going for, maybe.
Well, and you pointed this out when we were watching this, that, you know, the way the camera work does, because this is Kubrick, right?
Right.
And he is, you know, a fucking technician.
Yeah, like, he is
doing something with everything, and he is completely fucking careful. And you come in and you see you see him in his space thing, and you know, the camera becomes his eyes and sees, you know, the other person.
Right, it's a point of view switch.
Right, you become his point of view.
Yep, which is us, the audience.
Right, and then, but then it goes away from that, and then it does another point of view switch, so now you're the other him.
Right,
who's then looking forward. And so it's like, it keeps like, out, in, over, out, in, like, it keeps doing this through like his whole life, and then to the point where he turns into the star baby, which is the sort of big metaphor for the big visual representation
of evolution of intelligence.
Our new like infancy as this new being, right?
Right? Right.
And then the star baby turns and looks at the viewer, us.
Right, because it's like now, you know, all of us have, Kubrick is the monolith expanding our intelligence.
Yes, and it's actually super fucking dope.
Yeah, I mean, but again, I mean, I think it took me a couple of watches and having somebody explain it to me
mm-hmm.
before it made any sense. And it's like, and that, I mean, I get the appeal. I get, you know, for a lot of people who are much more advanced film watchers than I am, that sort of thing is really neat to piece together or whatever. And that's the thing that I find frustrating. I mean, and actually, even though I was an English major and I graduated with honors, and I feel like I have a pretty good grasp of the English language.
Yeah, I think you did too.
I had a hell of a time with understanding, the whole undercurrent of like metaphors or whatever. Like I think a good example is reading The Hunger Games and having to have somebody point out to me that the whole thing is a metaphor for United States world policy, and once they said that, I was like, oh shit, yeah, now I can see it. But I couldn't get there on my own, right? I really need other people to do that for me because I'm kind of dumb that way. And I feel like these movies are making me work for it. And it's like, I don't want to work. I want you to tell me what your movie's about.
You know? See, I guess I feel like, you know, that would certain, I don't know. I mean, I've certainly gotten frustrated with shit and thrown it across the room.
You get frustrated with stupid shit and throw it across the room because it's stupid.
Well, right. But I guess that's what I'm saying is that we like, especially with 2001, where it was filmed concurrently with the book, on some level, you can't really talk about it without having read the book as well.
Yeah.
And you know what I mean?
It's been a long time since I read the book, but I feel like the end of the book was pretty different. I mean, it had direct similarities, but I feel like it made a little bit more sense than Kubrick did.
Right. But I do think that there's a sort of like artistic parallax there. You know, that they're both kind of pointing at this third thing, the sort of Hegelian synthesis or whatever, not to get too fucking douchey, but like, it's too late.
That's okay. I already used the word gestalt.
All right. Well, I guess that's the kind of podcast it's going to be.
Yeah.
Anyway, but I don't know. I guess obviously most of the time I'm watching television when I'm tired and I don't care and I just want some
eat some dog food.
I'm gonna go eat some dog. It'll be great. But like I do appreciate this kind of film and it does make you work for it. And maybe this is just, I was talking to somebody at work about this where I was like, oh yeah, I totally spoiled myself on whatever the new Spider-Man. Right. Yeah. I went and figured out what all the, and like, I'm super excited because now when I go, like, I'll be able to see them set it up, right?
They actually did a study about this, that people who spoil movies for themselves enjoy the movies more.
Right. And so I kind of feel like that on, like, a level with this kind of film is, like, in general, I look all that shit up beforehand so that I have a roadmap when I go into it. And then I don't feel so miserable and hate everybody.
With a movie like this, and Primer, for that matter, I mean, I feel like reading the Wikipedia beforehand will actually enhance your experience of the movie itself, because it's told emotionally rather than like narratively or linguistically. It's harder to piece together if you don't have that context, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, unless you want to watch it two or three times with a friend and have a conversation afterwards and think
too.
About it for a week or whatever, because I remember The Fountain was like that for me, where I didn't like it at first. And it's not that I didn't like it, it's that I didn't understand it and that made me mad.
Yeah.
You know, and so, but it captured my imagination in a weird way. It was like, you know, you get that song caught in your head and you sit there and you have to listen to it again because like it's stuck in your head, whatever. And The Fountain was like that, only kind of visually and metaphorically, because it's like, it made me think about it. Like weeks later, I would think about it and talk about it and relate it to stuff. And it was just like, I'd never really had a movie do that to me before. I have since, like, but that was a cool experience, you know, and then I had to watch it again.
Speaking of like the life cycles of art appreciation, like I know I've seen The Fountain at least twice, if not three times.
Yeah.
Right. And I know every single time I finish it, I'm like, that was bullshit. Every single time.
Yeah.
But I'm in the cycle of The Fountain where I'm like, yeah, that was actually super dope.
I kind of want to see it again.
Yeah, I kind of want to watch it again. And
it
be
does
like,
that in your memory where it's like, it's like watching The X-Files and not knowing like what's going on. And it makes it more interesting.
Right.
You know, it's like, it's better that. Or like we were just talking about Boba Fett, where it was like this kind of really throwaway character from Star Wars.
Completely.
Who had nothing to do with anything. And yet now he's the biggest goddamn thing on Disney. It's
right.
Like Boba Fett this, Boba Fett that, Mandalorians. Oh my God, this is the coolest thing ever. And it's like, the reason is because we don't know anything about him.
And you can just
insert yourself or whatever you want onto that character.
Yep.
And
it's
and in that way, like, or nothing specific. And that's the beauty of that sort of thing, is that with this movie, with Upstream Color, you can put a lot of things onto
it. Yep.
And the less you actually explain, the better. Because if you explain it, then it becomes something concrete, and then you can't make it into whatever you want. Or like The Fountain, same kind of thing, where it's like, once you start putting things on it, then it's its own thing. And like, and I realize that I'm arguing the opposite point of what I started with.
No, but I think that's one of the beauties of this kind of film, is that it's real porous, man. You can put all kinds of shit in there. You can take it back out. You can rearrange it. Ooh, you want to hear a spicy hot take?
Sure.
Okay, so, I looked up this movie.
Yeah.
And Shane Carruth was dating the actress at the time.
Yeah. You could tell the camera totally loves her face.
Right. So, unfortunately, they have since broken up. They broke up in like 2018 or so.
Mm-hmm.
She has serious, serious permanent restraining orders against him because she has alleged really serious abuse. And yikes. Yeah, yikes. And I mean, I think that that's a read you could do.
Like during the movie, like he was
just during the relationship, which began in like 2011 or something. Hmm. So, you know, whatever. But I mean, the way her character is, you know, is sort of, I mean, you could read it as a sort of like constant gaslighting of her.
Yeah. So it was like method directing.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's that, I mean, that would this is an extremely spicy hot take. Is all I'm saying.
Yeah.
But you know, like knowing that about their relationship, or at least knowing that at least she said that about their relationship, like it does change the way you read certain things.
Yeah, I could totally see him as a control freak. I mean, one of the nice things about being the actor, director, writer, producer, and soundtrack,
cinematographer. Wait,
everything.
What is that called? Yeah.
Yeah. Sound engineer. He was all of it. So. But you can kind of see, like, from Primer, too. So we have two examples of his work. In Primer, he was kind of a control freak, too.
Oh, completely.
You know, and so he comes across as a control freak here to the point where we were like, wait, was that the original guy who drugged her?
Yeah. Because
it's kind of coming across like he was the original guy who drugged her.
It's kind of coming across.
It wasn't, but, you know, it was like, no, this is a different guy now.
Right.
And he's just, you know, trying to date her in a really aggressive way.
In a way that felt
like creepy
and wrong. And that's what we're reading. You know what I mean? Like, we're reading that there's like a messed up relationship there. And like,
because I mean, like the trauma of her experience that she may or may not fully remember was being given orders to write checks and put a mortgage on her house.
Well, and the whole like coded date rape at the beginning, you know, mm-hmm. what I mean? Like being roofied and not knowing what happened to you. And like, I mean, at one point, like when she comes to, she feels down in her vagina, like she's mm-hmm. feeling for the assault.
Yeah.
Which is really awful.
It's yeah.
Really awful.
I mean, in a lot of ways, what he did was more violating because he made her do it all herself, you know. I mean, it's just like, I mean, it wasn't even coercive in that sense. He just stripped away any kind of you know, ability to object,
right?
You know,
and she never really kind of she's never really kind of right again, you know what I mean? I think at some point,
well, for a long time she was on drugs for whatever, schizophrenia. And you know, I mean, obviously that's not what had happened to her, but you know, I think the drugs must have helped.
Right. Although, I mean, again, you know, that is, that's another read you can take, right? Is the mental illness thing. And
is she really schizophrenic?
Well,
and she just killed a random pig farmer for no good reason.
Aural hallucinations are actually a component of schizophrenia.
Yeah.
So anyway, I mean, there's just kind of a lot. There's a lot going on in this film, actually. And
there's a lot going on that you can totally latch onto in whatever way you want to.
Right. Well, because that was the other thing I was thinking is that, you know, speaking of control freaks, like this, you know, the collector character, what are we calling him? The pig farmer.
I think the internet was calling him the sampler, you said.
Oh, yeah, the sampler.
Because he samples the audio.
He does sample the audio.
Which seemed like such a nerdy hobby for a pig farmer.
Anyway, but he's not a pig farmer.
Literally, he farms pigs.
He's a psychic parasite farmer.
But he's...
Bro.
He's an unwitting psychic parasite farmer.
It's
not like he knows that putting the pigs in a sack and throwing it in the river is necessary for their life cycle. Like, you get the sense that this is a complete accident that happens once and will never happen again.
Right. But at the same time, you know, again, he's not a pig farmer because the guy says, I'll come and buy your piglets, and he doesn't do it because he's not actually a pig farmer. He's a psychic parasite farmer.
Well, he's more like a human experience sampler because he knows that these particular pigs will give him access to other people's really sad post-traumatic lives.
Right. You know? So okay,
and
so
that's what he's farming for his emotive inspiration with his weird ass music.
Right, and that's what I was gonna say. This would be my second spicy hot take. Would be like he is the artistic. He is the figure of the artist who then Ooh, goes
authorial over... insert.
Yeah, word.
Holy shit, early high five.
Yeah.
That's brilliant, man. Yeah. I love it.
So, but yeah, you can totally, like, where he's, like, he's mining people's trauma and...
Opportunistically.
Opportunistically mining people's trauma to then create art. And that's kind of what's going on in there.
Yeah. Okay. I love it.
Yeah, so...
I mean, you could definitely read it that way because we have no... actual like narrative to disagree with you. Give me whatever you want, throw it in there, it's fine.
No, but I mean there are things that it is and there are things that it isn't, you know. It can't be anything.
Yeah, you know? No, I mean, but that's the thing about it is that it's like loose enough that there's what happened and then there's like all of the layers of possible metaphor,
right,
you know, or even overlapping metaphor,
right.
And some of which could even disagree with each other, but it doesn't matter because it's all overlapping and fine, whatever. But I, you know, and that's the thing. Like, it had been so long since I'd seen 2010, like, because, you know, our friend Rob was like, you know, why don't you do 2001 and 2010? And I was like, yeah, it's been a long time since I've seen those. And I remember the end of 2001 being trippy. And maybe we could talk about some, you know, other related things, yeah, like
so
whatever.
Yeah, so I saw just my history with 2010. One is that I know I saw it when I was like 17. For sure I was in high school.
Oh, I'm sure I read it when I was 17.
And I've never read it, although I've read other things from that period, like Childhood's End.
Oh, yeah. They should make a Childhood's End movie. I heard they were.
Childhood's End is pretty great.
That's, speaking of like, evolution. I mean, that's about, like, you know, humans evolving and having an alien species show up to shepherd us through it. I mean, like, he's got a lot of work that sort of, like, Rendezvous with Rama, which... Villeneuve, I hear, is doing, and I'm just like, how are you going to do that and not destroy your career? I mean,
because Rendezvous with Rama is like, that's stupid.
An impressionistic book. Yeah. All of them are. And speaking of, like, not making any sense, like, he literally, it's like he'll describe the shapes of things and not tell you what it is or what it's for.
Nope.
And that's it. And that's what you get. And then, and you keep expecting the next book to maybe start explaining stuff, and they never do.
Well, I mean, Rendezvous with Rama is a perfectly cromulent book. Like, you read it and you're like, ah, the unknowable underworld universe.
Yeah, I mean, it was totally
readable. It's like a less philosophical, like, Solaris.
I just can't believe that you would move from Dune to Rendezvous with Rama. You
yeah,
know?
It does seem a little weird. But I was going to slag all of the later Rendezvous with Rama books, because there's like six of them, and they get worse and worse and worse. He wrote them with somebody else who has this huge tumescent boner for Eleanor of Aquitaine and Joan of Arc. Right. Do you remember this?
Oh, I forgot about
Do
that
you
stuff.
Remember this? And it was just like, could you shut the fuck up about these guys?
Yeah. Anyway. Because I mean, sometimes, like, actually having, like, a linguistic narrative like that is a bad thing.
Oh.
Because then you hear what they're saying, and you're like, oh, this is so stupid.
Yeah.
Could you have been more vague so I could at least think you were intelligent?
Right? So, yeah. So, first book, kind of okay. Later ones, God, dude.
Yeah, they were pretty bad.
And they also get into, like, that sort of, like, you know, that era of science fiction, the sexual politics. They're pretty...
Yeah.
Corrosive, and it's pretty gross.
So anyway, well, like, I mean, so we watched 2010 right after we rewatched 2001, and it was like, you know, I'd forgotten that it was like, what's his face? Is it Roy Scheider?
Roy Scheider, who
like, we're gonna need a bigger spaceship.
Yeah,
and they fly out to see what happened, and it turns out that Hal had gone crazy because he was given conflicting instructions,
right?
And he was told a lie, and because he's an artificial intelligence, the best way he could come up with to both meet the mission objective, which he could do on his own, he didn't need the humans for that,
right,
was just off all the humans. Like, why wouldn't you? You know, right. I mean, it's like, we're not dealing with Asimov's laws of robotics. We're dealing with telling this computer to lie, and it can't. And so it's like, well, I'll just kill them. Then I don't have to lie.
Right. Well, it told him that it can't tell, like, these people can't know the objective. And so he's like, well, the way to stop them from knowing the objective is to kill them, because they've figured it out already.
Right. And so, like, mission accomplished, right? So they get to the ship, and then they actually hitch a ride on a Russian ship, and then there's a whole
with
thing.
A tiny baby Helen Mirren.
Oh, that's right. And so it ends up being where it's like, now they have to tie the ships together and launch back to Earth, because Star Baby is about to turn Jupiter into his sun,
right?
And start and put a monolith on Europa, where there's some, like, nascent life, developing in a primordial soup. It's like a swamp. And then, like, and then there's this message that's broadcast, all these worlds are yours, because, like, now all of Jupiter's moons become inhabitable.
Right.
And except for Europa, don't touch that one.
Right.
And the movie itself is, like, not, definitely not a Kubrick movie.
Oh, my God.
It's just,
it is
like,
TV movie level filmmaking.
Yeah, it was just, I mean,
70s TV movie level filmmaking.
And much as, I mean, and I do, actually, I do appreciate Kubrick movies. I mean, I like what he does. I like that he makes all of this really obscure stuff. Like, if he had made Upstream Color, I think there would have been a lot more in the cinematography about color and representations of
metaphorical color.
No, he didn't. Because he doesn't care about that sort of thing. He's so much looser than Kubrick.
Well,
Kubrick had it all planned out. And I think he had the story planned out for Primer, but I don't think he really had a script. I think they just
No. We've argued about this before. If you look it up, he had, like, all of the money for that film went into actual literal film. He was not fucking around. Everything was scripted within an inch of its
life.
Actually,
that makes sense if he's such a control freak. Sure.
Yeah.
But it came off as not having one. But it felt a lot looser in terms of the filmmaking, because there wasn't a lot of like visual metaphor. There wasn't a lot of cinematography. It felt really digital handheld, you know? Like, and I think this movie kind of did too, even though there was a lot of, like, loving focus on flowers and random shit like that, and, like, having these scenes that, like, but I feel like they weren't interestingly enough staged, but more importantly, there wasn't anything visually symbolic throughout the whole thing. All of it was literal symbolism, like the pigs being connected to the people, and what that says about us. Are we just a herd of pigs for the slaughter? Like, whatever you want to put on that. But they were just pigs. I mean, there wasn't something like, you know, you've got a number and the number has meaning. Or when you set up a shot, it looks like something that it isn't, you know, kind of almost in a Dali-esque sort of way. Mm-hmm. Like, Kubrick would do shit like that all the time. Like, well, like the opening scene of The Shining, where the kid's riding on his little big wheel, and he goes what should have been a big square, except it's got spin one and a half, and he goes through five sides of the square before he comes back to where it starts. And you don't know that as a viewer. You just feel like something's weird.
Because it's too much.
Yeah, but you don't necessarily key on it. And maybe you watch it again a couple of times or have somebody explain it to you. And then you see it and you're like, oh my God, how did he do that?
Yeah.
Also, that's just freaky. And there were lots of things like that in The Shining where, you know, he would have something on the wall over the bed. But when he did the shot of the people through the mirror, it wasn't there. Or he would have chairs up against the wall, and then in the next shot they would be gone, you know. And so, like, there were a lot of things like that were intentional, just to, like, make it creepier, because he was making a horror movie.
Because it's like this, you know, like, you keep not being able to trust your surroundings on this subconscious level,
right?
Like, you can't know what the fuck is real and what isn't.
Which is
how that all works.
And I feel like, I mean, I don't know that 2001 is in the same class. I mean, I think that what he was talking about more, and this is sort of what brings a lot of these movies together, is, and a lot of movies of his era were about this sort of mind expanding, like, consciousness expanding evolution of human, like, because we're becoming more connected and more tuned in and more whatever, like, progressing along that evolutionary ladder to more and more enlightenment.
Right,
like, it was all about enlightenment, you know, and that's kicked off that whole,
and it's also just this sense that evolution is progress. They are synonyms
towards, like, a star child, like,
right,
you know,
it's
divinity,
inevitable. Yeah,
you know, and I think that comes through for sure in 2001. But I feel like that sort of visual metaphor that he's really known for with The Shining, I don't feel like it was really there in 2001. I mean, partly because it is a horror movie. It's not really. It's more of a sci-fi movie that's about the evolution of intelligence, right? Because, I mean, it starts with this huge, way longer than I remembered section about, you know, teaching great apes to kill each other or whatever, having that be a happy side effect of giving them intelligence. But I mean, because that's in there, it means that this is not a horror movie. It's not about horror. So he's not trying to visually destabilize you.
Right.
He's doing something else, you know?
Well, I mean, like, the one mostly what I remember from when I saw it when I was 17. Like, I remember the like flying over the landscape, and now it's blue, now it's purple. Because I was like, I remember being really annoyed with it. That part. I was just like, this is just dumb. But I get it a little better now. But the scene I remember really clearly is like the one ape kills the other one, and then with a bone, and then he throws it in the air, and it follows it through the air, and then it transitions, and it's the space station.
Yeah, which looks kind of like the satellite of
Yeah, it's
love,
got the
like
same
bone
kind of,
shaped.
there's actually a fair amount of like satellite of love energy in this movie. But actually, it's the second one that it gets really satellite of love. Anyway, and that's a, I mean, speaking of, like, that's a really wonderful shorthand for like, this bone is a tool that, you know, is used to murder, and then you throw it in the air, and then this is a tool, like the space station is
Could also be
also a
used for
tool.
murder.
Like, it can
And it
be.
turns out the AI does murder some
Right,
people.
it can like all of this stuff can be used for all, multiple ways, but it creates a very strong visual link between those two things. Like he's saying, these look, these are the same thing.
Well, and I mean, if you think about it, the ship is a representation of the AI, which is the tool that we developed that ends up killing some people. And the AI itself ends up being because it's a sentience, right? And then they
It's
end up killing the
alive in a way.
sentience at the end. But it's a it, it's a way of thinking. Like, for so long we have thought of ourselves as like the children of God or gods. And this is like, you know, our child. We've birthed this AI, and that is kind of to give us an anchoring point in our evolutionary process, where now we can step off and become more like the gods that we would have imagined, because we've created intelligence. We understand how to do that now and what's involved with it. Although I think part of the problem, and what the movie never really talks about, is like, can we, as a society, actually handle that? Which, in the years since, we've proven that we can't as a society.
Well, and I was gonna say, it's like, you know, the like it's Promethean in a way, because it's like the we're given fire, we're given technology by the monolith people, and then we create the AI, and then the AI kills us. And it's not, the AI doesn't kill us because it's evil. It kills us
No.
because we did it dirty.
We fucked with the sharks, and now the sharks are
They're
fucking
fucking
with
with us,
us.
yeah. But you know, I so it is actually a little bit funny to be like, you know, that our birth of AI is what makes the monolith makers think that we're ready for this
Oh
evolutionary
no,
step.
I think Kubrick was just using that as sort of a ballast, like a foil to the Star Child evolution. I mean, I think that that was just sort of like what he was doing with it. I don't even think Clark was necessarily doing that. Maybe he was, but I mean, I think the fact that the AI killed some people is sort of a parallel to the way that the early man
Oh,
killed
sure.
somebody,
Yep,
you
I
know.
can
And
see
I
that.
think it's just sort of like pointing at, you know, see, now we are the monolith for that this AI in a way. You know, we've given it intelligence. But I don't know. I mean, I think a lot of that movie was really about this sort of like, you know, mind expanding, like consciousness expansion, in the same way that I think that like The Fountain did at the end. Like, it turns out that the solution is to expand your consciousness until cancer doesn't exist anymore, or whatever tree, like tree bark disease that his wife had, she was a tree at the end. And you know what? I mean, I feel like maybe I do need to see that movie just so I can hate it again. But like,
This is bullshit.
yeah, but I mean, it took that sort of consciousness expansion to be able to. I mean, the fact that they were floating in a little like ecosphere bubble in the first place is pretty, you know, you have to have a pretty expanded consciousness for that. I mean, like, or maybe he was just super high the whole time. And then in Upstream Color, it was almost like a bastardization. Like, you have this new, like, almost technology, this way of connecting with other people that would be really revolutionary if you weren't just using it to steal everybody's money, like one by one. You know, I mean, I feel like, I don't
I
know.
feel
It had some
like
I mean, like, Limitless was one of those like mind expanding, like, here's a drug that expands your intelligence so far that you can do all of this stuff. And like, I feel like this almost is like a failed version of that. Like, if you had had that pill, but instead, you just used it to con people, you know?
Well, but I mean, that was something that we said about Primer, is that like these dummies yeah. create time travel. These dummies create time travel, and then they're like, let's play the stock market. Like it is a complete failure of imagination.
Well, but no, what they really do with it is like, let's go to this fuck like each other party over. And change time. Let's change the way it happened because we have perfect knowledge.
Right, so that we can have some like social currency that we don't currently have because we're a couple of dummies. Yeah. You know, like it's just
well, the implication so is the more they go back, the more they're damaging themselves.
Sure, you know, yeah, no, absolutely. But it is pretty funny because they have this unbelievably powerful tool and then they're just like, let's do this dumb bullshit.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I feel like that movie was super, super tight. I mean, and in part super tight. It had a narrator. You know, I mean, like that to me made the whole thing intelligible because if it didn't have that overlay, you would have no idea what was going on. You know, like none of it would have made sense. Well, and I feel he could have done that with Upstream Color, had just any kind of overlay that would sort of tie things together into a continuity. And instead, it is. Like Upstream Color is like it's a stream of consciousness movie where things sort of happen.
Yep.
And they happen linearly. I mean, like we're moving through time forward
for the most part.
No, I mean it's
there
like,
is some skip there is some skipping around in there though.
Well, I think only in the parts where, you know, like you had pointed out, where you want it to feel destabilized, unstable, you right. know. Which makes sense, but I think that like the whole thing just sort of, you know, races through and it's almost dreamlike, you know, and that to me was the part where I was just sort of like, you know, what it needs is a rug to help that room hang together.
I don't know. You know? See, I guess
and somebody took the rug from that movie and pissed on it.
Okay, counterpoint. Here's my counterpoint. Okay. You're going to really like this.
So, you're going to be like, no.
What?
Counterpoint, no.
No. Well, you okay. Wrong. No. That also, second part, two-parter.
Uh-huh.
Second part is that when we watched Halloween 2, the Rob Zombie Halloween 2.
Yeah.
And it opens with the, like, bullshit quote about dreams and violence or whatever. Oh, yeah. And you hated every single minute of that. You're like, why don't you just do it and we'll just figure it out.
Yeah, no, that's a fine line.
That's all I'm saying.
I'll give you that.
All I'm saying is I'm that...
You know?
You contain multitudes? Yeah, uh-huh. So, but I don't know. I thought, I guess we're in disagreement about this one, because I think it was completely what it should be.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to say that I didn't like it. I just, it's problematic for me, that's all. I mean, I think that I think it's well done. I think that the story is interesting. It's just, it just feels really loose.
Yeah.
And unconnected in some ways.
No, you know? I feel that. I mean, I'm not... Again, I think that, like, all of these films that we're talking about are incredibly polarizing. You know what I mean?
No, absolutely. Well, I think the thing they have in common is that they're fairly experimental. You know, I mean, like, the end of 2001 was revolutionary for its time. Like who does that? You know?
Right.
Who just completely takes the entire thing and, like, just makes it this visual, like, explosion of... Right. Of stuff that you just sort of have to try to piece together.
Right.
But ultimately doesn't really make any sense. You know, I mean, it makes emotional sense, I guess, but it's like,
but
you
it know, is.
you kind of like what ends up happening is 2010 is sort of the appendix for 2001 where it goes through the glossary and explains.
Right. No, what all the words absolutely.
Mean, you know what I mean?
Absolutely. Although,
which is why it's less of a movie. I mean, I think that the source material isn't as good, but also the execution of the movie wasn't as good.
2001, you mean?
2010.
Oh, 2010 is a disaster area.
Yeah.
It's so bad. Like the acting is bad. Everything is bad. I hated it.
Yeah.
It was definitely one of those things.
I didn't hate it. It was watchable. I would watch it once every probably 30 years.
I will never watch that movie again.
Well, give it 30 years.
No.
I'm just saying.
No.
There are a few movies that I say I will never watch that again. Actually, we've watched some of them and discussed them on this podcast. More than one of them, I think, was like a movie that I swear I would never watch again. And then I did just for this, which is sort of funny. But
yeah,
I don't know. I didn't hate it that much. It was just, it was just,
I guess
it was just a sci-fi movie. You know?
I don't know.
That's the thing. Like I think 2001 is mischaracterized as sci-fi. I don't think it really is. It's philosophy. It's weirder, you know? I mean, it's like, yeah, it takes place in space with a spaceship, and yes, there's an AI, but it's about like, not religion exactly. It's about metaphysics. It's about cosmology. It's about how we look at the universe and our place in it. For sure, you know, it didn't have to be a sci-fi movie. It just was.
Right.
You know?
Well, I mean, I think that this is like an argument one can make about a lot of genre, is that there's all kinds of genre writing out there that isn't strictly, like, it doesn't go according to the strict definitions, right?
Oh, yeah. And absolutely, and like, sci-fi is definitely the genre to explore philosophical concepts more so than you know, Westerns or, right. You know what I mean?
Well, like, or... like,
unless you're Tarantino, I guess.
Speaking of Westerns, I think that there's a lot of argument about whether, like, say, Cormac McCarthy's The Road is a genre or not.
Right, yeah. And, is that science fiction? Well, Margaret Atwood claims that she's not science fiction.
Right, and, you know, I mean, and on the level that she doesn't engage in fandom, she's not part of that. She's more speaking to literary tropes than she is to genre tropes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. One could make that argument pretty clearly.
I guess, but the Matt Adams stuff is, like, that's absolutely a post-apocalyptic science fiction story, for sure.
I would completely agree.
You know?
But I'm just saying that there are taxonomies for how these things function that would put it outside.
Yeah, but I guess what I'm saying with 2001, I feel like, to put it in its context, it came out in, what, 1969? Mm-hmm. What was happening at that point? Yeah. I feel like, as a society, our consciousness was being expanded by a lot of means, by drugs, through collective action, through, you know, like, all of this stuff that we were doing back then as a society, trying to push forward civil rights, you know, women's rights, like, all of these things that they were doing were very, very much in line with, like, we are progressing forward.
Right.
As a society, we are expanding our consciousness, whatever. And so you have something like 2001 come out and talk about, like, our next step of evolution as a society. And it's just disappointing that in the last, you know, 50 years since that movie came out, like, we've totally failed.
Right.
We've completely failed the hope and promise of that movie. We've completely failed.
Right. No, I agree. I mean, I feel you. But I do think that there's a certain, like, kind of streak of naive optimism that one gets from these sort of white male authors who just sort of see the sort of transcendence of all of this technology and the rest of it. And then the reality for most people's lived experience is that, I mean, because the civil rights movement was bloody. You know, the women's rights movement was bloody.
Yep.
Like, there was unbelievable unrest. Like, my dad graduated in 1968, and, you know, he was class president. He was set to give a speech, and 2 days before Bobby Kennedy was shot and killed. Mm-hmm. And he changed and wrote something completely different that hadn't been vetted and kind of got in trouble. yeah. I actually read it at one point. It's really interesting. You know, so, I mean, because, like, I've always thought this is an interesting factoid, like 2001, which is this very technical, you know, it's got this huge bombastic score.
Oh my
like,
God. We didn't even it's talk
wonderful.
About the score.
It's wonderful.
It's like all Richard Strauss.
It is. Yeah. And then,
I feel like what he was doing is like, this is the best of humanity's music. And if that's going to be the soundtrack, is this glorious, like, music.
Well, and it,
you know,
I mean, it's also like a literal space opera, right? Like, the term doesn't come from nowhere.
Yeah.
So then the same year, Night of the Living Dead comes out.
Yeah, no, I mean.
And you look at like the stark difference between, like, the amount of money that goes into them, but also just, like, you know, Romero's vision of what's going on the ground is a lot more brutal.
Yeah, yeah, no, but I mean, I guess my point is, though, that like, it's. I feel like this is less of a sci-fi movie. It just happens to be taking place in sci-fi. Another example would be, there's a movie called Altered States with, I believe, was it Jeff Bridges? But it's about, like, going into this, I think they take a drug or something, but they go into these...
Don't they, like, kill themselves?
No. They go into these deprivation chambers where you, like, float in super salty water, and it's all dark, and you don't have any sensory input at all. And they start regressing into like proto humans, and he eventually like turns into protoplasm at some point. He's like gone so far back in his whatever. But the whole thing is sort of like modern day, and it's sort of played as this is what could happen right now. It's not necessarily sci-fi so much as it's just sort of like mind bending, you know. It's actually almost a horror film by the end. But I think that like there's so much overlap between sci-fi and horror for those reasons. A lot of like when you start talking about metaphysics and cosmology, you start running into these bigger questions where you're like, oh my God, I'm all freaked out.
Right. You know? Well, I mean, that was something I thought while I was watching Upstream Colors. I was like, this is a Cronenberg film with all the body horror stripped out of it. I'm dead serious.
Yeah.
You know, like I thought it was going to go that way when they were like, you know, farming little sawbugs. Because I was like, that's really gross and don't do that. But, and it could have gone that way very easily, I thought.
Yeah.
It just didn't.
And I'm happy it didn't, because that's not really what this movie was about. I mean, and as much as I
Cronenberg is a lot squishier.
Get mad at myself for not understanding things at the first pass, I do think that this was a good film. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, I think that it was well thought out, well executed. I liked it.
Yeah.
I would watch it again, even.
I would watch it again. Not real recently.
No, not right now.
No. Not even next year, though.
No, probably not.
Yeah, but I
not
mean,
30 years from now either.
2001, I definitely would watch again. 2010 yeah. can suck it.
Yeah, terrible. But we should watch The Fountain.
Yeah, we totally should.
And then hate it.
This is bullshit.
High five.
High five.